Mike Royko is one of our most popular newspaper columnists. His syndicated column appears in 525 papers. He's won dozens of awards, including the Pulitzer Prize. And for 3 years in a row, he was voted America's top columnist by the readers of the Washington Journalism Review. Royko has been writing a daily column for more than 26 years in his hometown of Chicago. He gained a reputation for his affectionate portrayals of the town's ethnic neighborhoods and his biting commentaries about Chicago's public officials, in particular, the late mayor Richard Daley. Royko later went on to write a biography of Daley titled Boss. Royko's recent columns are collected in a new book called Dr. Kooky, You're Right. In one of the columns, Royko writes about a time when he was stopped at a traffic light and a teenage boy started washing the windshield of Royko's car, hoping to get a buck in return. Royko turned on the wipers to get rid of the kid and drove off in anger, but he was later angry with himself because he realized the kid needed the money.
I make a point of giving money to all panhandlers. I think by the time anybody's a panhandler, for one thing, the overhead is high. I don't like to give to charities where I read reports and find out they've spent 80% on administration and the rest goes to the poor. The one thing about a bum, if you give a bum a buck, there's no overhead. I mean, he gets the buck.
So you give money to everybody who asks you for it?
Yeah, I've never turned a panhandler down. I don't believe in it because, as I say, whether the guy's problem is that he's a drunk or that he's got a drug problem or that he's mentally addled in one way or another or he's given up on life. The only problem with that is you can't get a tax write-off.
How much change do you carry with you?
I don't give change.
You give dollars?
Yeah.
So you always carry a wad of singles?
Well, it's a good idea to carry a wad of money in a city like Chicago. Because if you're robbed and say you only have $3 on you, anybody goes to the trouble of investing in a gun and going into a line of work where you can go to prison is going to be disappointed if all he gets is a handful of quarters. So I generally carry quite a bit of money on me, so in different parts, pockets and wallets. So that I can, if I have been robbed, and I think that if they hadn't been pleased that they were showing a profit for their effort, they might have shot me. So it's a really a minor investment, giving a guy 50 or 100 bucks to avoid getting shot.
So you've been robbed a couple of times, and did you have money with you both those times?
Oh yeah, because I follow that rule. I learned that a long time ago.
Would you ever tell a mugger who you are? You know, on the odd chance that maybe they read your column and like it.
I'm not a name dropper. No.
I wonder what kind of reaction
you
get.
I can give him my card. actually, that happened in Chicago. Studs Terkel was mugged in front of his house. And the guy started wrestling with Studs. I guess Studs tried to talk to him. The guy started wrestling with him, and they wound up on the ground. And while they were wrestling around, Studs told him who he was. And the guy said, "I've heard of you. You're a writer and a well-known personality and all that." And Studs, "That's right." And so they had a talk, but the guy still robbed him. But being Studs, who's a compulsive interviewer, he did get a good interview out of it. He discussed things. As they were rolling around, he discussed things with the guy.
With his tape machine on?
No, he didn't. No, he didn't have a tape. The guy would have stolen his tape
machine. That's right. How do you think the tone of your columns has changed over the years?
The tone hasn't really changed, I don't think. I think the subject matter has changed considerably. When I first began my column, I stuck basically with local Chicago Midwest issues, primarily Chicago issues. Chicago politics was a great deal more fun then. And Richard J. Daley was mayor. In the 60s were... It was easy to write a local column in Chicago. We had most of the things that were the great social issues of the day that they were babbling about in Washington were happening in Chicago. The civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, every major or minor social revolution was occurring here, and most of the problems that people talked about then were here. So by writing a local column, I was actually writing, without realizing it, a national-type column, except I was at the source or at the base of the problem rather than in Washington where people put things in the Congressional Record. But as the years went on, it would have been impossible for me to just write about Chicago happenings and Chicago politics. And so the only change has been that I've broadened the base of the things I write about.
Columnist Mike Royko is my guest. He has a new collection of columns called Dr. Kooky, You're Right. You lived in Chicago all your life. Would you describe the neighborhood you grew up in?
Well, it was, I would say it was probably what you call an ethnic neighborhood. It was probably about 60% Eastern European, then a mixture of Irish and Scandinavians. It was a blue-collar neighborhood. There were no... we had a lawyer, a neighborhood lawyer, and a neighborhood doctor, and a neighborhood this and that. They didn't live right in the neighborhood. They went home a mile or two away to a fancier neighborhood when the day was over. But it was basically a neighborhood where people sat on their front porches at night and had a couple firemen, a copper, and two or three taverns on the block, and a neighborhood school. It was all things considered, a fairly stable neighborhood. There wasn't much crime. There wasn't a lot of money. We were at the tail end of the Depression, and then we came out, and then we had World War II. So it wasn't a real prosperous neighborhood. Most people didn't, the majority of people didn't own a car.
I've seen your father referred to as a tavern tycoon. What kinds of bars did he run?
Well, he had a tavern, and over the years, that's where he had a tavern. It was really basically his first tavern. Later, he sold that and bought taverns in other parts of the city, trying to, you know, get a bigger and more profitable place. But that was where I grew up, was where he had his first tavern.
So your father ran one of the bars in the neighborhood?
Yeah, he had the most popular bar in the neighborhood.
How old were you when you started hanging out there?
Well, I didn't hang out so much as I swept the floor.
Right, and, right.
Well, we lived above the tavern.
Oh.
You always did that. I mean, that you didn't have absentee tavern owners. Most taverns came with a flat in the back or a flat upstairs, so you lived there. So that was really just the first floor of my home. It's where the music came from. It's kind of nice. Developed a pretty good taste for Glenn Miller and the big bands of the era, because unlike most kids had to listen to a little radio, I had a great big jukebox downstairs.
Right. Did people treat you really well there, all the patrons of the tavern, since you were the son of the owner?
Well, they had to, because I tended bar. I started tending bar when I was 12 or 13, so that was due to in those days, taverns had very friendly relations with the police. You had local police stations, and every Saturday, the bag man, the captain's man, would come around, and I'd give him an envelope, and that assured us that if there was a fight in the tavern, they'd respond quickly, and the fact that I was only 13, they would accept my father's word that I was an elderly midget and could tend bar. I was treated well. I was more generous than my father when it came to giving up free drinks. So they liked me and the customers. And
say, how much money was in that envelope?
I never looked. It was sealed. That was a matter between my father and the local police commander. Although he told me years ago, years later, one of the newspapers in Chicago opened a tavern. They had an investigative reporters open a tavern and just wait to see what happens when you own a tavern in Chicago. And pretty soon people came in, building inspectors and the police and different parts of the local government seeking bribes of one kind or another. And my father was amazed when he read this story at how inflation hadn't really had that great an impact on bribes, because he told me that in the 40s he was paying more than that. And so since I didn't work on the paper that did this expose, I did a piece saying that the main thing we've seen is that the people who take bribes in Chicago are kind of dumb. They haven't really kept up with inflation.
Now, your father took bets on horses, and didn't you have to run some of the money to, to a bookie?
Well, my father, the fact that he took bets made him a bookie. Anybody who takes
But you had to run into a mafia bookie, though, didn't
you? Well, yeah, because at a certain point, if you're just a small, if you're a tavern and you have but you take bets on horses or other sporting events from customers, there's a point of danger when you can't cover a large bet, or you can't cover if there's a lot of heavy betting on some event, and should you lose, you don't have the capital. And in those days, my father, today he could probably just go and go to the junk bond people and borrow several million dollars and cover it. But in those days, if you couldn't pay off, you'd have trouble. You know, like your legs might get broken. So it was a routine. You would go to the big bookie. You weren't operating without the big bookie's permission in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would just take the overflow or the big bets and lay them off with the big guy, because he could cover them. And it was his responsibility, since you were also paying him a franchise fee, in effect, to stay in business.
So,
really does sound like basic American businesses today. You know, for you, bookies were franchised, and you go to the guy with them, instead of going to Wall Street for the extra dough, you go to a syndicate guy down the street who is probably just as honest.
Well, did you or your father, though, ever get into any trouble with the mafia?
Oh, no. My father used to go to the Kentucky Derby for a year with these people. They were nice people. Most of them are, they rarely get involved in violence. That really, they try to avoid that. They're not like the modern, Scarface, Al Pacino type criminals who go around shooting up the joint at the drop of an insult. Nor are they glamorous operatic type figures as in Coppola's movies, The Godfather saga, but they're just ordinary thugs who are just making a living.
When you started attending bar when you were 12 years old, what was some of the advice your father gave you about when to talk to a customer and when to just be quiet, and when, if ever, to stop serving a customer if they were really drunk or if they were causing trouble?
I don't recall his ever having to give me any advice, because I had grown up in the atmosphere. Before I attended bar, my job was sweeping up, and I sort of absorbed it. It really isn't that complicated to attend bar in a neighborhood tavern. You didn't have to know how to make a martini. I don't think anybody ever ordered one. The standard drinks were a shot or a beer or a shot and a beer. Women generally had a highball, just a shot of bourbon with some ginger ale in it. I don't recall anybody ever asking for champagne or a pink lady or anything, a daiquiri. I think my father would have told them, why don't you go to a Spanish neighborhood if you want a daiquiri, whatever that is. We just didn't have, it was a very easy job. Anybody could tend bar.
Do you think it's helped you as a columnist to have grown up around a tavern?
Well, it helped me as a Chicago columnist, I think, to have grown up in Chicago. When I wrote a 1971, I published a book on sort of an unauthorized biography, or really not a biography, just sort of a subjective view of Richard J. Daley and the city and the political machine. And when people asked me when I started researching the book, I said, yeah, I probably started research about when I was 7 or 8 years old, when I started understanding how things worked in this city. And I was well into my research by the time I was handing the sergeant the envelope. And yeah, if you grew up in a town, it helps a lot when you write, if you're going to write about it.
Mm-hmm. But have you ever, consciously gone to hang out at a bar specifically just to overhear conversations, see what people were talking about?
No, actually not. I don't go in that many bars. I'm at a point in life where I can't do my work and sit around in bars. It's just only so many hours in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what they're saying. This week they're probably saying that Mike Ditka was stupid to trade McMahon, and they're saying that William Perry is fat and ought to be traded. And that's about what they're saying, probably, in those bars.
Mm-hmm. Were there columns that you wrote early on that got you into trouble with City Hall, that really aggravated the people in City Hall early on in your career?
Oh, well, yeah. When Richard J. Daley was mayor of Chicago, I was probably his major adversary, which showed what a cushy deal he had. I was better known than the people who ran against him, and I gave him more grief than the people who ran against him. And but someone had to do it, and he was fun. He was fun to write about. The machines. See, the papers had never really covered, as far as I was concerned, the real politics in Chicago, and they had never described the people in politics in Chicago the way they should have been. And I started going to city council meetings and taking recorders with me, and then I would print exactly what aldermen said, and people would say to me, "My God, that was a great expose." just quoting them.
Mm-hmm.
Then I started going to Mayor Daley's press conferences and doing the same thing and quoting him precisely. And that was fun for a while. I did a number of columns. But then the press secretary said that if I didn't stop, he'd stop holding press conferences. So the press corps in City Hall pleaded with me, "Go away, or we will be cut off from the source of information." But I kind of pioneered the realism of Chicago politics, and I recall with some relish in 1968, a week before the convention, I wrote a column about what the Democrats could expect when they came to Chicago in 1968, what kind of guy Daley was, and what the machine was like. And I believe it was the L.A. Times, which got my column over our wire at the time, rejected. They didn't want to print that. Instead, they got a guy in Chicago, a college professor, to write a piece on Daley. And it was a very laudatory piece on how he was misunderstood, et cetera, et cetera. And after the L.A. Times stopped paying the hospital bills for all the reporters who got whacked on the head that they had here, after the convention, one of the editors told me, he says, "I think we made a mistake. I think maybe we should have printed your piece instead." People didn't understand Chicago politics. Even a lot of Chicagoans didn't. So if I made any contribution with my column in Chicago, that was about it.
How do you think Chicago politics have changed?
Oh, it's more conventional now. It's closer to being politics as it is in other cities. With the added ingredient of race, but that's we're not the first to have that. And it's changed because there is no longer a dominant political machine. That's changed for a number of reasons, primarily legal decisions that have almost killed off about 98% of all political patronage. When Daley became mayor, he controlled a minimum of 40,000 jobs. And a rule of thumb in Chicago is that each job is worth a minimum of 10 votes automatic. So you had this gigantic machinery with loyalty to one guy, ultimately, the Daley, who was both the mayor and the head of the party. That's changed.
Mm-hmm.
Today, you've got two parties in Chicago. You have the white party and the black party.
You think it divides that clearly?
It couldn't be divided any more clearly than that.
Of all the columns you've written over the years, can you single out any one of them as having the most impact?
Oh, gosh, no. No, I can't. But that's not why I do a column. I do columns because I think that at some point in the newspaper, somebody should be able to stop, take a breather, and get a laugh. And that's basically what I try to do with my columns. I don't try to take things... Even when I try to take things seriously, I try to write them in such a way that the reader will go away with at least having laughed once or twice.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your columns and about your life. Thank you.
Thank you.